The following is a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900 CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Good morning, gentlemen. Good to see you all this great weekend.
Good morning, Scott. Morning, Mitch.
Good morning, guys.
So I guess, you know, we've often talked about financial planning. One size doesn't fit all. It depends on your own personal situation. But even certain industries, you really can't compare. For example, doctors, which pretty much they're running their own small business, are they not?
Yeah, Scott, you're completely right there. Definitely person-to-person financial planning. That's one area, but also profession-to-profession too. Every single job has a different structure and how they go about their financial planning. I mean, if you look at DeFasco employees, they're going to have a totally different area of financial planning than someone running at their own practice in the doctor area, the resident physicians. So the median debt for a medical school graduate is $90,000, with 34% of students reporting debt of $120,000 or more. And this is from the Association of Faculties of Medicine of Canada. And so then you also add that to your debt from your undergraduate, and the average for a Canadian debt going to university is actually $28,000. So right out of the gate, you're looking at a very large sum that you're going to have to start paying back once you're no longer considered a student. And physicians, they also have lots of expenses that they have to run as well. You mentioned that it's basically running your own business. And so they have a lot of expenses to run this business, and they have personal financial needs as well as business financial needs. So they do have a very complex financial planning structure, as well as other areas. They've got, there's lawyers, there's dentists, so there's other professions that have similar needs that are similar to doctors as well. So because of all the schooling physicians start with, they also start their careers much later, which has given them a shorter earning period. So as I mentioned, they've got that massive big sack of debt there, right out of the gate.
It's funny you mentioned that, Mitch, because, you know, they not only start later, but the expectations are so much higher. So they may start as a doctor close to age 30, but, you know, they may look at, okay, we look at having kids now, and they're looking at a house at that time. And do I buy a building for my practice? So much is hitting them all at once. And does it make sense? How do I arrange this? How what's the best way to create a financial roadmap for a physician?
Yeah, and with no pension, they also have to carefully structure this, because they have to build their financial plan for their retirement on their own. They don't have someone creating that pension for them. And so they do more than other areas in the business world need a comprehensive financial plan. So as we've mentioned so many times on the show, that every person is different, and you should get a personalized financial plan for you, instead of there really no one shoe fits all. So, but the first decision you have to make when it comes to this for doctors is should they, and when should they incorporate their business? So incorporation in Canada has steadily risen to 70% today for this profession. And the decision is usually made within the first few years of practicing, and the rationale for incorporating has changed over time as the tax laws has changed throughout the years. So while incorporation provides many options for arranging your compensation, saving for retirement, it also adds complex situations to your plan as well. So these are very smart people, but I can guarantee you they're not teaching this stuff in med school. And just like when I was in business school in finance, they weren't teaching me how to perform surgery. So we each have our specialty here.
It's actually funny you mentioned that, because when we do sit down with doctors, that's the one thing they do all say. I says, oh, why don't they have a class for this? You know, we learn all about the medicine side, but we don't know the business side. And I said, well, I guess that's why you have us, is to make sure. And again, it comes down to having that trusted professional to create that path of here's what you should do, and here's how you create a financial plan for your specific industry.
Yeah, you mentioned that trusted professional. And I know we've talked about this before, and I've heard stories out there that because they do have that kind of per se target on their back of, it's kind of the first profession you think of who's making a lot of money out there. And And when people are making a lot of money, there are others that want to kind of pitch them ideas, to sell them ideas that maybe they don't need. So you need to have that trusted professional out there and make sure that you're working with them constantly, because they're the ones that are going to be the fiduciary for you, and they're going to look out for your best interests. And they're also going to be the ones keeping up with the constantly changing financial environment as well to give you the best advice.
Yeah, you know what? The word fiduciary is something we just take for granted, Mitch, but as part of being a certified financial planner is a fiduciary, meaning we look after clients' best interests. You always suspend your own self-interest to look after the benefit of the client you're talking about. That is right in writing our CFP. And as opposed to, you know, somebody pitching an idea, as you mentioned, or selling a product, they are not fiduciaries. So it's so important to have this person that will make sure that you're doing the best things for you and your family and your practice, of course, your medical practice.
Yeah, and that's 100% what you have to be when you are a CFP professional, and those should be the people that you're working with when you're earning any sort of income like that, being a doctor. So incorporation provides many options for arranging your compensation and saving for retirement. It also has a lot of complexities for your financial plan. The rationale for incorporation can vary from physician to physician. So like we said earlier, even for between physicians, it's still not the same. It's not one shoe fits all for each person. So there are three reasons for incorporating your practice. One of them is income splitting to take advantage of the lower tax brackets. The other one is tax deferral. You can achieve by retaining after-tax earnings from an active business in the corporation for investment. And the third one there is flexible compensation. So by incorporating, you get the ability to tailor the amount, the type of compensation that you want. You can do all salary, all dividends, or you can do a combination of both of them to your personal cash flow. And this is something that we go through with lots of our clients and making sure that they're doing what's best for their situation. So not every situation is the same. And some years you may want to pay more dividends than others, or maybe more salary so that you qualify for CPP. There are a lot of different factors to this, but we'll go through income splitting first here. So income splitting is a strategy that shifts the reporting of taxable income from high income to a low income, typically a spouse, child, and sometimes a grandchild, which thereby is reducing the family's overall tax bill. So there are several tax rules in place to limit the situations where income splitting is permitted. So before 2018, the incorporated physicians were able to have it pay significant dividends to a lower income spouse or adult children, and they have since changed that. And that would be with the TOSI rules. So the tax on split income, they're now expanded. They're now reduced that you're not able to pay as much. So they have to actually qualify as an actively engaged employee. So there are a few scenarios here that they will be able to do that. And if the family member must be 18 years old and the family member must be actively engaged in the business of the corporation on a regular continuous basis in the current year or in any of the prior five taxation years. So what does it mean to be actively engaged? That basically means that you have to be there at least for 20 hours a week. So if you do work there for 20 hours a week, you are qualified and you can get a qualified salary paid to you throughout this corporation. The other is a broadly applicable exception. And it's called the age-based exception. So if the owner of the corporation is 65 or older, this exception is going to prevent an opportunity for you to basically split that from your corporation. And it's very similar to income splitting when it comes to your RSPs or your other pensions when you get older as well. So the primary motivation for incorporation is to access the low corporate tax rates that apply to income from active business. So if the active income is earned by a Canadian private corporation, which is when you incorporate, including professional practice, the first $500,000 of active earnings is eligible for the small business deduction, which gives a corporate tax rate of roughly 15% in Ontario. Every province is different. So if you're in different provinces across Canada, it can range, but this is roughly what it would be in Ontario. As the small business tax rate is generally much lower than the owner's personal tax rate. The retained profits inside the corporations result in a significant tax deferral. So the benefit of tax deferral can mean income available is going to pay down the business debt or invest more for retirement. So instead of paying 53% on your income, you could pay 15%, which is going to leave a lot more money there for your investments to grow more.
Yeah, the other nice thing about paying 15% tax, obviously 15% tax is fantastic, but you can then have certain expenses that are paid with those monies. So you've got more money to pay expenses that you can use for the business. In one area, I know we've talked about many shows is life insurance. And if you can use 85 cent dollars to pay for life insurance rather than 47 cent dollars to pay life insurance or other expenses, doesn't matter which one, it is far better bang for your buck. So you're actually using money that you normally would never receive because you would have paid it in tax to help pay some of your bills.
Yeah, 100%. I know life insurance is great for putting inside the corporation when it comes to doing that. I know lots of doctors that we have do utilize that. Another thing here is that there's a variety of strategies that can be used to minimize the impact of the small business deduction. So what is the small business deduction? It is when the passive income rules tie the amount of the small business deduction, currently 500,000, to the amount of the passive income earned by the corporation and associated corporations. So once the passive investment income earned by the corporation passes $50,000 threshold, the small business deduction will actually start to grind down by $5 for every $1 you're over that $50,000. So there are some ways to kind of minimize this grind, and one is by maximizing registered savings. Another one is by creating an individual pension plan. And the third one here is portfolio construction. So I know you, Don, you utilize this a lot. You do a lot of corporate structure here when it comes to construction of the portfolio. What would you suggest doing to minimize?
Oh, without question, the last thing you need is interest income inside of a corporation because that is going to be taxed at 50% because it's passive income. So you do want to utilize capital gains and then you can defer tax again on the growth of investments. So yes, our largest clients by far are ones that have corporations. And so to have the proper investment plan inside the corporation as well as outside the corporation is extremely important. Again, this all comes back down to no, there's no one size fits all. And dealing with doctors is just one example of that.
We are planning our financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Going to take a quick break here. We're coming back.
You are listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. It's tax time. Here we go.
Isn't it a great time? Yes, you just got outside that RSP season, if you will, and February is behind us now, and that means April 30th, which is the deadline to file your income tax, is not that far away. And so most people do file their tax returns, thankfully. Weirdly enough, though, and what percentage of Canadians do not file their income tax on time, if you had to guess? What do you think, Scott?
50%?
50? 50?
Yeah.
Oh, thankfully, it's a lot lower than that. Mitch, what would you guess?
I'm taking 27%.
It's 12%.
Oh,
okay.
Wow.
So 12%. So basically, one out of nine people do not file their income tax on time, or don't file it at all, for that matter. And this is, I actually thought that was high. You know, one out of nine, you get, 30 people in a room and three people haven't filed their income tax return on time. So, okay. So look around the room next time. And this is, what are they missing out on? Well, first of all, I can tell you what they are going to end up paying. If you owe money, Okay, if you owe money on your tax return, you are going to owe a, there's a 5% penalty right out of the gate. And on top of that, you will then pay 1% per month. Okay, so if you, let's say, if, for example, there's, you end up owing $5,000 in income tax. You had a, say, a large capital gain in your portfolio, or you worked a part-time job and they didn't take the proper amount of tax off, and you owed about $5,000. Well, right out of the gate, you owe two, if you didn't file by, you say you filed May the 1st. Oh, you're only one day late. Ah, doesn't matter. $250 for filing one day late, 5% penalty. Then they will start charging you 1% per month penalty on top of that as an interest charge, which is $50 a month. Okay, so that's only on a $5,000 tax bill, if you will. So now I didn't know, and I thankfully, I guess I haven't had any clients that, actually, I did have a couple clients do this. They missed a few years of tax returns. And the rationale, this one individual, this is, well, I don't owe any tax, so I just don't bother doing it. Now I'll catch up sometime. Well, next thing you know, 3 years have gone by. Well, let's say you did owe tax and you found out, oopsie, I owe a little bit of income tax here. Well, you actually then would owe 10% penalty, okay, versus 5%. And instead of 1% per month penalty of interest, rather, it's 2% per month. So now you're almost like a credit card interest rate in terms of the interest charge. So if you, same example, if you had a $5,000 tax bill, and you did this for 3 years, it would be $1,500 in penalties. Okay, 5,000 at 10% times three. So $500 times three is 1,500. Plus, instead of $50 per month penalty, it would then be $100 per month penalty. It would compound, because then you would have owe more on top of that and more on top of that. So it would be somewhere over north of $6,000 over a course of 3 years. So extremely expensive. Okay, for that 88% of people that do file on time, perfect. You don't have to worry about this. I'm just thinking, okay, there is some people that don't, and you should probably look at it. Now, then I often hear, well, I didn't owe tax. Well, that's great, okay? But you also could be missing the boat on things that you could be claiming, okay? And first of all, let's say you getting a refund. If the government owed you a few thousand dollars, they're not paying you interest on that. Okay, you're not making any money on this. And just because you didn't do this, it's not like a bank account. It doesn't work both ways. They charge you a penalty if you owe, but they are not going to pay you interest because you didn't file. Now, if you filed and they owe you money and there's a certain amount of time for a delay, they will start paying you interest, albeit at a far lower rate. Okay, so yeah, there's a lot of tax credits that you can claim. And this is why lower income earners really need to file their income tax return, because there's so many things. There's a child tax benefit. It's basically a monthly tax repayment for kids under 18 years old, and it's income related. So if the government doesn't know what your income is, you won't get paid. So families with combined income of under $34,863, call it $35,000, you would actually qualify for the maximum, which is $619.75 a month. Not bad, okay? But you have to file your income tax return, okay? So that's not a bad deal. Claiming medical expenses. Well, you have all these medical expenses, perhaps. Well, you get to claim these costs, and those actually go on to the lower income earner. Now, if you're a new parent, you actually get to claim some of those costs too. If you invested in prenatal care, some of those could be deducted on your tax return. And additionally, through fertility treatments, you can also claim those expenses on your tax return. So a lot of people don't realize some of these expenses you cannot claim, and rightfully so. Who the heck knows all these rules? And this is why you do have to kind of keep on top of this and ask your tax preparer, what can I claim? Do you have all of them? And this is perhaps a time to have a good tax preparer, because if you're simply using somebody that's just putting in the numbers and doesn't really know the rules, you may miss out on some of these. Things such as taking advantage of unused tuition costs. So if you have a child and they're going to post-secondary, the child gets to claim the tuition costs first, but anything left over, the parent gets to claim. And that's important. And so, you know, especially with the cost of tuition these days, and generally speaking, the child isn't earning enough while they're going to school to claim all those tuition costs so they don't have to pay income tax. However, in this case, it makes sense. Yes, Mitch.
Another one, because I know you're talking about young individuals here when it comes to tuition costs, but this will be the first year that there will be FHSA, first home savings account deductions, for anyone that contributed in 2023. So they could have opened this, put $8,000 in, and they, if their income justifies it, they could deduct $8,000 from their income. But having a proper tax preparer, like you just mentioned, maybe your income doesn't justify it, and you can actually carry forward these deductions indefinitely. So your tax preparer, hopefully they're not just entering numbers. Hopefully they're telling you how much you should actually use, because it may be worth your while to postpone that FHSA deduction for future years when you're earning more money.
Yeah, great point, Mitch. And it's kind of interesting. I had a client literally on the last day of RSP season, February 29th, say, oh, you know what? My son earned an income. I was thinking we should put some money into an RSP for that child. Well, they live at home. The kid's, I think, 19. And his income wouldn't justify it. However, I did suggest, well, if you're going to think about putting money anywhere, it should be the first-time homebuyer savings account. And you could put up to $8,000. And to your point, Mitch, you don't necessarily want to claim that. And this is so important. You know, you can claim this when you're making $100,000 a year and get a 43% tax deduction, versus if you're earning only, say, $30,000 a year, and you're only getting a 20% tax deduction. I know people quite often would rather see a kind of a bird in the hands, better than two in the bush kind of thing. they want to see the money. Give me the money. But if you can have some patience.
Let's get some delayed gratification here. Why save at 20 when you can sometimes save at 38 or 43? It's free RSP room. You only get one chance to do this. Once you buy a house, you can't use this account. Trust me, I wish I could.
Yeah, no kidding.
I can't. You get free RSP room to do this. It grows tax-free and you can take it out. You don't have to pay it back. It's a great account. And if you can carry those deductions forward indefinitely, save it for later. You're going to get a bigger bang for your buck.
Yeah, no question. And I guess there is the exception if you say, okay, I'm out of the housing market and I'm going to rent for a while. You can rent 4 or 5 years, get back in the housing market, and you actually would claim. You have to be 4 years of not owning a house. So there is that loophole, if you will, but I'd probably not worth getting out of a house just to so you can contribute to a FHSA. Again, following your income tax return, you also get the GST and HST credits. And those are fairly significant. It can be $496. And if you're single, or $650 if you're married. And this is an annual amount. But again, all these things add up. And they will be received quarterly, July, October, January, and April. Again, you need to file your income tax return. Benefit from tax relief from the Canada Workers Benefit. And this is it's a supplement. It includes a disability supplement if you have an approved disability tax credit certificate. Okay, so they'll add up to about $1,400 for a single individual and $2,461 for families. Keep in mind, you no longer qualify for the CWB when your income, net income, is more than $33,000 or your family net income is over $43,000. So these are for the lower income people, but there's so many. This is the thing. There, it's absolutely incredible how many benefits, particularly for low-income Canadians, there is. And we generally don't deal with them, I have to say, but maybe the kids of our clients may be in that situation, perhaps hopefully temporarily, they have a lower income, and therefore they would qualify for these tips right now. So it comes down to, let's get that tax return done and get, you know, to get the biggest bang for your buck. And it almost should be a must. I was actually surprised it was as high as 12%. I know you guys are thinking 50 or even 25. I thought 12 was high. So now there's a few newer areas this year. And the first one is, if you actually do it by paper, not a whole lot of people do it by paper, is it's about 20% less pages. So they've taken out a bunch of pages, generally instructions on that weren't being used. So 30 pages were taken out of the tax booklet. The one that I think a lot of people may not be aware of is the office, home office one. So during COVID, everybody was allowed to have those expenses, and you could do it two ways, the easy way or the hard way. And the easy way was $2 per day if you worked from home, to a maximum of $500. You know, it was actually interesting. My daughter works from home, and she did it the hard way the first year of COVID. And then she looked at it, and when it was all said and done, it wasn't a whole lot different than $500. Okay. It was like it was less than $600 and greater than $500. So it took her a lot of time to gain an extra $50 or something, whatever it was. But that is no longer the case. So you do have to go back to the pre-COVID rules. You have to have a completed T2200 declaration on conditions of employment that you are working from home. This is a common form, but your employer does have to sign this. So important to do this. And then you think, okay, if I get this signed, what can I claim? Well, based on your square footage or number of rooms in the house or the office you're using, you can claim a portion of your electricity bill, your heat bill, your water bill, and even a portion of your condo fees, home internet, maintenance and minor repair costs. And if you're renting, rent paid as a portion of the rent can be also claimed. So this could be a significant amount, but again, you do have to use a longer form. So don't just think, oh, copy last year's and I'll just do it. You won't be able to find last year's. That line does not exist. In fact, some people, husband and wives, quite frankly, were living in the same house, both working from home. And therefore you have to actually say, okay, what is kind of commonly shared? So you actually get a smaller one if you share. It makes sense. But if you're sharing the same office space, therefore you don't get to claim the same amount twice. Now, if you're self-employed, you actually get to claim a little bit more. You need to do a bit more work on this. So you get the home expenses, no different, but you do get a couple more expenses. So one is you actually get to claim the mortgage interest if you are a self-employed individual, and also property taxes. So those are not in the employee one, but they are in the self-employed. So it's, again, another form. It's a little longer form, fairly well laid out, I must say. So again, your tax preparer would be very attuned to doing this. If you're doing it yourself, it's not the hardest thing to do, but it's just a little tedious. So things such as, again, a couple new things this year, deductions for tools. They've raised it from $500 for eligible tools as in a deduction to $1,000. So you get an extra $500 as a tax deduction this year. As Mitch mentioned, the first time home buyers plan, this is the first time you'll get to deduct it. Whether you do is something you should work out with your financial planner to make sure you're doing it properly. There's a multi-generational home renovation tax credit this year where you can claim up to $50,000 if you are in qualifying expenditures. And this actually works out to a maximum credit of $7,500 per claim, okay? And this is a good one. It's just a matter of time for this to happen. I think it took a little while during COVID. Residential property flipping rule. Starting in 23, any gain of flipping a house is going to be added as an income and not a capital gain. This is a big deal. So if you, the definition of flipping meant that you bought a house and sold it in less than 365 days. So within the year, you bought and sold it. It is income. It is no longer a capital gain. So that's just a quick 10,000 foot view of the new changes. And I'm sure we'll be talking about some more tax tips going forward.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. A quick break here. We're coming right back.
You are listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. We're talking about TFSA pitfalls today.
Oh, that was funny. Yeah, thanks, Scott. Yeah, RSP season is officially over. And now that we can focus on other accounts here, and the next account that we usually like to focus on is TFSA. So we're in TFSA time, let's call it. And there are lots of benefits to the TFSA. Brief history, it started in 2009, started as a small account. I think it was $4,000 or $5,000 is what you could put in at that time. And now we're at 2024. And if you were born at 1991 or earlier, you can contribute $95,000 if you've never used it. So that is a very useful and large tool to use. We're now seeing lots of TFSAs in the mid hundreds to 200,000s now. So people have been utilizing this tool from day one and it's grown substantially. But what mistakes can you make when you're using a TFSA? So the first one to avoid when making is to avoid making a withdrawal and replacing the same withdrawal within the calendar year. So you can make a withdrawal from your TFSA at any time and there's no tax consequences to do so, even if it grew by double. It doesn't matter, you're not going to pay tax on it. However, a withdrawal does not reduce contributions made during the year. So the amount withdrawn will only be added to your TFSA the following year. So this approval applies when you have a TFSA fully maximized. So if you put $95,000 in, you're not going to be able to take money out in this year in 2024 and put it back in the same year. So that's going to cause a over contribution in your TFSA. And when you over contribute to a TFSA, you're going to pay a 1% per month penalty for over contribution. And because this account has grown substantially, it's become pretty difficult to track contributions. It says on the CRA website as to what your TFSA contribution room is, but every company reports at different times and not necessarily, we've seen ones that aren't necessarily correct. So double checking is a good thing to do when you're looking at your room.
Yeah, if I can add to that, Mitch, I know personally I checked my CRA site and it was wrong. You know, it hadn't received last year's, even though my last year's contribution was earlier in 23, it still didn't have it recorded that I'd made it. So if I just went by the CRA website, I would have over-contributed by $6,500. And of course, they would then be charging me the 1% penalty. So yes, definitely be very aware of what you've contributed to this to the TFSA.
And the best way to kind of avoid this risk is to not set up multiple TFSAs. It's so easy to set up multiple TFSAs, and sometimes you don't even know you did. The banks, they tend to promote them as bank accounts. They'll call it a tax-free savings account that you're just sitting in cash. That still counts as a contribution, whether it's invested in stocks, mutual funds, ETFs, or just sitting in cash. It's still a contribution to your TFSA. And every company doesn't talk to each other. We don't know what you contributed to a different institution when you're holding it at ours as well. So it's very easy to have this over contribution when you have multiple TFSAs. And you're also not getting double the room by having different TFSAs at other institutions. I wish it worked like that, but you can't have 95,000 at IG, at Scotia, at TD. You just can't do that. And I know it is actually a more common than you'd think mistake to think that you do get more TFSA room when you're at different institutions. So that's one way to definitely avoid, is to not open them at different institutions.
In fact, you know what? Some of the worst advice we get for clients is from a teller, and they just see that you have a significant amount of money sitting in your bank account. And they say, oh, we can move that to a tax-free savings account for you. They never seem to ask, do you have your tax-free savings account elsewhere? Are you at the maximum? And for those people that are think, okay, well, I guess so. That sounds like a good idea. You end up with a massive interest penalty. And so this has happened a number of times to our clients. And I'm thinking, okay, before you make any TFSAs, all your TFSAs are with us. Have it in one place. It makes it real simple.
It's so easy to just create another one. They're even calling me and they know where I work to open another one. So it's pretty funny. But another thing you have to do is to recognize how market gains and losses impact your future contribution limit. So holding a volatile investment in a TFSA, it can be risky for a couple of reasons. So first, if a capital loss is realized, that loss can't be used to reduce other taxable capital gains you may have, unlike if you were holding this in a non-registered account. The second, only the amount withdrawn can be added back to the TFSA contribution limit the following year. So for example, if your $5,000 investment decreases to $4,000 and you take it out, you can only recontribute the $4,000, which effectively shrunk your TFSA contribution limit. So if you didn't actually grow your TFSA after hopefully years of having it, you can reduce and overcontribute to your TFSA by having riskier, more volatile investments. And it's a very common thing to do there. Other situation that I do see with TFSAs is to actually avoid naming your spouse as a beneficiary, and you should actually name them as a successor holder. So if you intend on using your TFSA as an estate tool, which we highly recommend, it's one of the best estate tools going, it will be beneficial to name your spouse as a successor holder instead of a beneficiary. So this rule only applies to your spouse. You will not be able to use this with anyone else. If you name them as a successor holder and you pass, the TFSA will effectively become theirs when you pass and become the new owner of it, as well as if it was always theirs. So not only will they get your TFSA, they'll also have theirs as well as their room. So this will increase the size of the TFSA they're capable of holding. Also, if you name them as a beneficiary instead, the spouse will be liable for any tax from the time of death to the time of the TFSA distribution. So it's a significant difference to have them as a successor holder instead of a beneficiary. And this is something that your financial planner should definitely be going through with you.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. A quick break here, and we return for our last segment.
You are listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. We're going to talk about the Canada Pension Plan.
You know what? It seems to be sometimes a very overlooked, it's almost a right for the Canadians to have this CPP, yet for some reason, people think it's not that great. And they seem to be skeptical at times, and I don't quite get it. Under the new enhancement, CPP will eventually replace about a third of pre-retirement income if you got the maximum. So, depending on income, okay, of course, if you're a very high income earner, you would not be getting a third based on Canada Pension Plan because it's based on insurable earnings. So right now it's about $70,000. You make, $70,000, you're pretty much topped up into your Canada Pension Plan, which is great. But it is designed for this, and it's really, I do find out that we talked about this, and I know Mitch mentioned about self-employed people such as doctors, that their accountants are saying, well, they will pay a lot of dividends. And I know we had a client come in just a week ago, and he was only earning dividends. Well, the problem with earning dividend income is you do not contribute to the Canada Pension Plan. It saves tax now, but you do not get the Canada Pension Plan later. And, to me, it's like one layer of security. It's a pillar, and you can have lots of other investments over top, but it's truly a risk-free asset for that long-term investor. And there's not many that have this. Plus, it's a hedge against three major areas: longevity risk, inflation hedge, and sequence of return risk. So longevity risk, I just And one more month, my oldest male client will be turning 101. Okay. And this is,
wow.
Yeah, again, thanks. Yeah, it's not common still
yeah,
for
wow.
males to live over 100. And he's doing great. We just spoke to his son just 2 weeks ago, or a week ago, rather. But it's amazing how many people are living longer. But how have they planned for this? And so the nice thing about CPP, it's indexed with inflation. You will not run out. It goes until your life ends. And it's nice to have that. Very similar to a government pension. So I look at this as, you know, for somebody that doesn't have a government pension, it's their version of it.
He's really gotten good value out of his CPP.
He's definitely one. And again, it's kind of interesting. The rate of return obviously is greater. So if you live, and they also watch what's the rate of return of CPP. Well, if you contributed for 39 years, start age 26, and you went right till 65 and you started collecting, and you lived to the average age of a Canadian at that time, it's about 2% return. Okay. Not what you would consider great, but at the same time, it serves a purpose. And if you look at it compared to, say, GICs, they certainly on that, generally speaking, are not averaging 2%. I know they are now, but they certainly haven't been for a long period of time. Now, if you started at age 70 and you live to 95, the internal rate of return turns out to be 3.11%. And, you know, you look at some of the balanced portfolios out there, say making 4%, well, this is risk-free. You don't have to take any, there's no variability. You don't have to worry about the market going up and down. So yes, longevity risk is it takes care of that for sure. And it allows you, because you've got this guaranteed area and you know you're getting this paycheck, you can maybe be a little bit more aggressive with your investments and they can earn a higher rate of return. So that's just another benefit. Inflation risk, I didn't mention it. It's indexed with inflation. Nobody ever really thought of that too much until 2 years ago when all of a sudden CPP was indexed 6.4%. And, you know, investments don't get indexed. This is the only in product that you can get. You can't get this on the side. You can't, as a private investor, you can't say, I want an indexed benefit such as this. And so this is great, or it's very difficult to buy it on your own. So this is an indexed pension for you. And it also gives you some other benefits such as disability. So if you're self-employed, you may not have disability coverage. I know it's not the best disability coverage, but at least it's something. So there's added benefits. And finally, there's a sequence of return risk. And we've talked about this on a few shows earlier, and we'll probably get back to it again. But when the market's down, it's not a great time to be pulling money out of investments because you're now cashing in more shares when the market's down. Of course, when the market's going up, no problem. So this avoids that sequence of return risk. So when at the end of the day, you're solving three issues that every investor needs to look at from a retirement perspective: longevity risk, inflation risk, and sequence of return risk. And Canada Pension Plan checks all those boxes.
We have been planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox have been here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Thank you, gentlemen. Another fabulous show. We'll chat again next week.
The preceding was a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900 CHML.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.